Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
My fellow Americans, thanks for joining us on the Bill Press Pod. And on this Friday, March 4, about 8:30 in the a.m. Washington time, welcome to this week's Reporters Roundtable, with lots of big news to talk about, starting with the war in Ukraine, now in its second week. And Russia so far has managed to seize only one Ukrainian city, even though Vladimir Putin insists everything is proceeding according to plan. So what's really going on? Can Russia be stopped? President Biden used his State of the Union speech to rally the nation behind Ukraine and to try to rally Congress behind what's left of his legislative agenda. Will it make any difference? The Texas primary kicks off 2022 politics, setting up a classic governor's race between Greg Abbott and Beto O'Rourke, and a high-stakes runoff for attorney general between the Bush Republicans and the Trump Republicans. And the January 6th committee drops a bombshell accusing former President Donald Trump of breaking the law in his attempts to overturn the 2020 election. Will he be charged with a crime? Well, that and a whole lot more to dive into with today's all-star panel. Leah Askaranam, welcome back to the roundtable, Leah, now co-author of the On Politics newsletter for the mighty New York Times. Hi, Leah.
Good morning, Bill.
Alex Eitzwald, senior digital politics reporter for the mighty NBC News. Hi, Alex.
Good morning, Bill. Thanks for having me.
And Esvi Date, White House correspondent for HuffPost. Hi, Charisse. Welcome back to you, too.
Hey, Bill. Thanks for having me.
So there it is on day 9 of the war in Ukraine. This was shelling outside the city of Kharkiv this morning. And ominously, Vladimir Putin yesterday telling France's president, Emmanuel Macron, that he intends to go and vowed to go all the way to the end in Ukraine. It was the focus of the first half of the State of the Union speech this week. President Biden putting on his commander-in-chief hat to kick things off.
6 days ago, Russia's Vladimir Putin sought to shake the very foundations of the free world, thinking he could make it bend to his menacing ways. But he badly miscalculated. He thought he could roll into Ukraine and the world would roll over. Instead, he met with a wall of strength he never anticipated or imagined. He met the Ukrainian people.
So, Alex, you've been doing a lot of reporting on Ukraine. What strikes a lot of us is that day 9, how slow the Russian advance has been and how much they are actually targeting civilian targets. What's your overall take?
Yeah, well, this is unfortunately a bit of both good news and bad news for the Ukrainians here. The good news, of course, is that the Russian advance has been slower than expected. I talked to a lot of people, former U.S. And current officials at the early days of the war when they took Chernobyl, the nuclear power plant. I was trying to figure out why, and the word that I got was that that was the quickest way from Belarus to Kyiv, and the intel all said that Kyiv was a 36-hour objective for the Russians. Well, we are many more than 36 hours into this, and they have not taken Kyiv. So that's the good news. But the bad news is that the Russian playbook going back to the wars in Chechnya, basically the way that they've conducted themselves in their kind of backyard, global backyard, is that when things are not going particularly well, they just crank up the violence. They shell residential blocks. They care less about, civilian casualties. There's unconfirmed reports that they're even talking about public executions in Ukraine now. And so far, the resolve of the Ukrainian people has been very strong, but, you know, we're less than 10 days into this. And if they start indiscriminately killing civilians, you know, that could really change things.
And Charisse, at the White House, the president, despite all the sanctions that have been put in place, is still getting pressure from some people to do more, particularly a ban on Russian oil imports or a no-fly zone. What do you hear from the White House?
Yeah, well, they've been pretty clear that a no-fly zone is basically an act of war. And so if we want to get into it with Russia, good way to try.
That's World War III, right?
It very well could be, right. And that's why there's zero interest in doing that. As to the ban on Russian oil, you know, they probably will get there eventually. But, you know, I find it hilarious that Republicans have been whining about oil prices and gas mm-hmm. prices now for months. And look at this Biden inflation. And now, you know, this would actually raise gas prices even more. Probably not that much, since a lot of companies are on their own refusing to buy Russian oil because of the uncertainty. But it would raise them some. And then, of course, do you think that the Hugh Hewitts of the world would turn around and say, well, you know, it's a sacrifice we all got to put up with because of what... the Ukraine invasion itself, though, I mean, you know, I covered a narcissistic sociopath every day for 4 years, and this is scary as hell. There's something. I'm not a psychologist or a therapist or anything like that, but the man is weird. He's sitting at a table like 100 feet long from anybody else. There's something going on, and what happens when nothing is going to plan? He's got nothing to lose, I fear. And I don't know how this ends.
Right. Leah, is this maybe the one event or series of events that can do anything to bring maybe more political unity in this country? I mean, we know where Donald Trump is on Vladimir Putin, but I was struck by what Mitch McConnell didn't hesitate when he was asked about Putin this week. Here's the Republican leader.
There should be no confusion about Vladimir Putin, and there's been some confusion lately. He's a thug, he's a killer, and this will not end well for him.
Now, so is that the Republican Party position here, and are Republicans and Democrats really united in this area, Leah?
Yeah, I mean, I was kind of surprised during the State of the Union, which I'm sure I'll get into, about how it was a topic that seemed to bring Republicans and Democrats together so effectively, when just, you know, a couple weeks ago, we were seeing Donald Trump, who's in many ways, most ways, the leader of the Republican Party, praising Putin. But I guess it shouldn't be that surprising. We have seen Republicans in the Senate part with Trump when it comes to foreign policy before. Even if they won't criticize him directly, we have seen them, you know, take votes separate from what Trump has advised, things like that over his administration. But it is kind of fascinating. You know, we thought that maybe there would be this moment of unity for Biden just among Democrats because of the Supreme Court nomination, maybe, you know, jobs numbers getting better. But really what we're looking at now is a completely different narrative. That's, you know, the story is Russia, Ukraine, and it does seem like Republicans, at least in Congress, the ones who are being vocal about it, are generally on the same page. And even more wildly, it looks like a lot of the world is on the same page on this one. So it's pretty wild.
But do you think that this could be, for Trump, the bridge too far, that gives Republicans finally the opportunity to just break with Donald Trump and publicly and just no longer, you know, embrace him as the head of the party? Or they still will stick with him?
I don't. Just because we've done this so many times before.
I know. We keep looking, we keep looking for what's going to turn the tide, right?
Right. And I mean, we saw Republicans, you know, criticize Trump for his approach to Putin during his presidency and for his positions on North Korea. I mean, this isn't totally out of step for Republicans when it comes to foreign policy. So, And again, with, I mean, with Mitch McConnell, it's a whole other kind of, you know, Mitch McConnell and Trump are not on the same page in general. You know, Mitch McConnell is an enemy of Trump's at this point. Trump does not like Mitch McConnell. You know, you can't even kind of put those two positions together. The Republican right. Party is so divided in so many ways in the post-Trump era. And I think that gets glossed over a lot because they are in the minority and therefore there's a united opposition to Biden. Right. But when it comes to actual taking positions on anything, including foreign policy, I don't think there's all that much to unite them. But it does seem like this Russia-Ukraine war has done more than we could have expected.
So you mentioned the State of the Union. Let's get into that. We saw, particularly at the beginning of his remarks, President Biden's determination about the war in Ukraine, and he ended. We saw a very passionate, very energetic Biden about the State of the Union, and that our best days still lie ahead of us. Here he is.
I've come to report on the State of the Nation, the State of the Union. And my report is this: the State of the Union is strong because you, the American people, are strong. We are stronger today. We are stronger today than we were a year ago. And we'll be stronger a year from now than we are today. This is our moment to meet and overcome the challenges of our time. And we will, as one people, one America, the United States of America. God bless you all, and may God protect our troops. Thank you. Go get him.
Alex, go get him. Did the speech achieve what the White House wanted out of this State of the Union?
Well, I'm sure the White House would love for it to achieve, you know, 80% approval ratings and the Build Back Better passage and all that. But for what a State of the Union speech can achieve, I think it was pretty successful. I mean, Biden is not the world's greatest speech giver, I think it's fair to say. And this was a pretty good speech for him. He seemed, you know, upbeat and engaged. And this is a tough moment to have a lot of enthusiasm about the state of the world, frankly. So I think he did a good job of that. And it recalled to me his stump speech from the campaign trail, where he would always end with this kind of refrain about, you know, never bet against America, get up, get on your feet.
Yeah, right.
Very classic Biden. It did feel a little disjointed to me with the top of the speech all about, you know, Ukraine and this kind of overriding rhetoric, this big rhetoric about, you know, how we're all going to join together and fight. And then it seemed like they just kind of slapped that on top of the rest of the speech, which was your classic kind of laundry list of agenda items. So, you know, I think the State of the Unions are less and less important as we hear more and more from presidents in other means throughout the year and from other politicians. But as far as any State of the Union goes, I think they have to be pretty happy with it.
And Sharish, we did not hear the phrase "build back better," but we did hear a lot of pieces of the former "build back better" bill. So, is the reset of the agenda sort of taking it like one step at a time and lowering expectations?
I have no idea what the point is of renaming "build back better." What is it now? Building a better America or whatever? I mean, I was on the Wisconsin trip right afterward, and
right.
I saw the new placards and everything. I said, okay, I guess we're moving on to the same thing, except with a different name. You know, it is now Friday. I dare you to ask the average person on the street what they remember of the State of the Union address. And I doubt that most people even watched it. And those who did probably forgotten all about it. Luckily for Biden, the people who tend to watch these things on a passing basis, not political junkies, probably saw the first 15, 20 minutes. Mm-hmm. Which were probably the best and the most cohesive and the most unifying, all about Ukraine. It gave him a chance to be the commander in chief. I think what happened was Republicans assumed that the whole thing was a bluff, that Putin was going to threaten, and eventually Biden would give in somehow, and then, you know, they could blame Biden for giving in. And instead, once the tanks started rolling, now we have them required to say, you know, this is unacceptable. Putin's a criminal, et cetera, like like Leah pointed out with Mitch McConnell. So did the speech work? It was a terrible speech. It was like four different speeches with zero transitions between them. I mean, as a work of craft, it was bad. Fortunately, no one cares, right? it doesn't matter even a little bit.
So, Leah, one of the things the president did try to establish was 6 million plus whatever new jobs, right? 5.7 growth in GDP last year, that the economy, we still have challenges, particularly inflation, but the economy is growing stronger and stronger under his watch. Reinforced just a few minutes ago on this Friday morning when the new jobs reports come out, 678,000 new jobs created in the month of February 2022 and unemployment rate down to 3.8%. That certainly boosts, adds a boost to what Biden was talking about in the State of the Union.
Absolutely, and theoretically. So I think what's tricky for Biden is he inherited a really tough situation, obviously, pandemic and the economy, not to mention, you know, a former president who was determined to set Biden back potentially for a new presidential bid in 2024. So in that sense, Biden gets to say things are better. And what we've seen before is that that's usually not quite enough for voters. That said, if people feel the effects of this, then I think Biden gets rewarded. We haven't seen numbers come out, polling numbers after the State of the Union, and really after Russia began its mm-hmm. invasion. But what's tricky is, I mean, I just wrote about the 1982 midterms where actually Ronald Reagan had a kind of similar situation. I mean, his economy was much weaker than ours now. But basically talking to Republicans who worked with Reagan and historians and all that, it's just really hard to argue that things are better unless people are feeling it. And in order for people to feel it, I think inflation is kind of the key issue. So, you know, let's see what happens with inflation over the next few months. But it's definitely not bad news for Biden.
Right. I guess we can't leave the State of the Union before we at least have to mention that once again, the idea that maybe all of us grew up with the State of the Union was at one time, at least if you didn't agree, people sat there politely and listened to what the president had to say and might even find something to cheer about. It has now become a platform where the crazies who want to make a point will do so, even at the point of being rude and ill-considered and just basically bad manners. And of course, I'm talking about Lauren Boebert. Mitt Romney maybe had the best word on some of these freshman members of Congress who keep acting out. He said last week on CNN, here he is.
I'm reminded of that old line from the Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid movie where one character says, morons, I've got morons on my team. And I have to think anybody that would sit down with white nationalists and speak at their conference was certainly missing a few IQ points.
Of course, he was there talking about Marjorie Taylor Greene and Paul Gosar. Alex, I haven't heard Kevin McCarthy be quite as strong as Mitt Romney. What's going on?
Yeah, McCarthy is not quite ready to exorcise these members from his caucus. He took pretty strong steps against Marjorie Taylor Greene. I think it was before the new Congress had even been convened last year, maybe, you know, immediately afterwards, stripped her from her committees and whatnot. But you know, it's kind of a funny situation because these are two freshman lawmakers who have very little actual power in Congress. I mean, Marjorie Taylor Greene is literally, you know, she just doesn't even have committee assignments. But they get outsized attention and they want outsized attention. And it's a tricky thing to know how to respond to it because they do this outburst in a calculated way to get notice. And then, you know, I'm seeing all these liberals in my Twitter feed who are tweeting about that more than the content of the State of the Union. And I feel like they succeeded in what they were trying to do. You know, they wanted to trigger the libs and they successfully triggered the libs. And then it kind of becomes the thing that we talk mm-hmm. about and pay more attention to. McCarthy could do a much better job of keeping these people in line, but they're just responding to the incentives of the modern political, social media environment where, you know, you do something outrageous, get noticed for it, get donations from people online, get booked on cable news or whatever. And, everybody does it to some extent. This is beyond that, but it's a long ways from, who is it, Joe Wilson, who yelled, "You lie" at Obama. Right. And that was such a shocking moment then. And now this kind of feels like, you know, another day in Washington.
Yeah. For the record, I'm not the only one. The morning after the State of the Union, because I happen to be, I think, on everybody's email list, I received a fundraising solicitation from Lauren Boebert bragging about her disrupting the State of the Union speech, which convinces me that was all planned ahead of time. They had this whole thing ready to go, and just didn't happen on the spur of the moment. All right, we got a lot more to get to, including the bombshell report from the January 6th committee on Wednesday evening, which we'll jump into with today's great panel, S.V. Dante, the White House correspondent for HuffPost, Alex Seitzwald from NBC News, and Leah Askaranam from The New York Times. Hold on, the rest of the week coming up in just a moment. First, we want to say a great word of thanks to our sponsors for today's podcast, the International Brotherhood of Teamsters. Good men and women of the Teamsters Union, they are the largest and most diverse of all America's labor unions, over 1.5 million members strong, and they represent just about every possible sector of the American economy, from construction workers in Las Vegas, vegetable workers in California, brewery workers in St. Louis, and bakers up in the state of Maine. As they say, the Teamsters represent everybody from A to Z, from airline pilots to zookeepers, all still under the leadership of outgoing President Jim Hoffa. So we salute the members of the Teamsters Union, direct you to their website to find out more about what they're up to at Teamster, their great work at Teamster.org. That's Teamster.org.
This show is part of the Pro-Democracy Podcast Coalition. We're partnering with the nonpartisan group Represent Us to promote efforts to protect the freedom to vote and pass laws that will make our government truly inclusive. America's democracy faces urgent threats, but there are ways we can build a fairer path forward. So if you care about this issue, like we do, visit represent.us/podcast to learn more. That's represent.us/podcast.
Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Hey, I'm Jamie.
And I'm Justina.
And we're the hosts of Just So You Know, a podcast where we get to the bottom of suspicious stories and outright lies we're being told by companies that profit off of animals.
You think Elon Musk is shady? Wait until you hear our episode about his sinister brain experiments.
First he ruined Twitter, now he's coming for your actual brain.
No.
We've also got one about that time I stormed the runway at New York Fashion Week to protest Coach's leather handbags.
Yeah, I heard they weren't happy about that.
I couldn't tell you. They're not talking to me at the moment.
And we're just getting started. In the coming weeks, we're going to blow the lid off of everything from shady pet dealers to monkeys held hostage by coconut milk companies to the astonishing secret behind the "no animals were harmed" message you see at the end of movies.
And so much more. We'll hope you join us for this surprisingly fun journey full of strange characters, secretive companies, and a whole world of stuff they really don't want you to know.
Subscribe to Just So You Know wherever you get your podcasts and look for our new episodes every Thursday. Just So You Know is a PETA production.
And we're back here here on the Bill Press Pod and today's Round Reporters Roundtable. Leah Askaranam is co-author of the On Politics newsletter at the New York Times, Alex Seitzwald, senior digital politics reporter at NBC News, and Sheree Stotte, the White House correspondent for HuffPost. It was Wednesday evening, Sharice, where the January 6th committee came out with its report saying that their investigation shows that Donald Trump and his allies were actually involved in a criminal conspiracy, their phrase, criminal conspiracy to overturn the 2020 election. Let's start with this, Sharice. Why isn't this getting more headlines, Sharice? It's just because people already expected it or what?
Well, it's not getting more headlines because there's this war going on in Ukraine right now. There's that.
Good point. Yeah.
The other part of it is, and the polling shows this, that most Americans are just over January 6th. I mean, they were appalled when it happened, but they never really appreciated that this was a fundamental, like, existential threat to the Republic, that what Donald Trump wanted to do was to overturn the election and remain in power. Right? We don't have a republic at that point if that happens. But people didn't see it that way. They saw it as a riot of Trump's overzealous supporters breaking things, going in, hurting police officers, beating them. A bunch of people got killed. But ultimately, it wasn't really a threat to the country. That's the overriding sense of most people. So what the Justice Department has been doing is been laying the groundwork for this for months. A lot of people who broke in and tried to stop what was going on that day were charged with interfering with an official proceeding. That is a crime. And judges have upheld that these people who tried to do that can be charged with that. So it was not a big surprise to me anyway that this was used in a filing by the January 6th committee in trying to get one of the lawyers who was helping Trump, John Eastman. He did all his coup planning emails on his work computer, which, by the way, you ought not do, right? Do it on your personal server. Don't do it on the work computer if you're going to do a coup. But so he's trying to block that. And the committee saying, no, you need to turn them over. And here's why. There's a crime fraud exception. What you were trying to do was illegal. You don't get to claim attorney-client privilege. You weren't even his lawyer anyway. So it's always struck me that if people who are entering the Capitol trying to stop an official proceeding can be prosecuted for that crime, how in hell do you not prosecute Donald Trump? I mean, that's exactly what he's trying to do from December 15th forward after the Electoral College had met. I mean, his people were on TV bragging about what they were doing. I mean, Stephen Miller was on Fox saying, we're going to send up our own electoral slate, totally illegal, and they're going to use those instead. Well, that also is blocking an official proceeding. So, bombshell, because maybe people hadn't realized that's what DOJ was doing for all these months. Whether it ends up in a charge, well, you know, we'll see. But the groundwork's been there, and it's been there for a year.
But Leah, don't you think that if they come to this conclusion that the committee must ask the Justice Department to file criminal charges and the Justice Department must launch an investigation, how can they just look the other way?
I mean, it's, I think, like, one question is kind of like what's politically acceptable or what's politically popular right now.
But are you saying that Merrick Garland would be driven by the politics rather than
No, I'm saying that I think that the bigger question right now is what does Trump do in the future? What does Trump do in 2024? And while Americans might not be all, you know, super excited about this commission right now or have moved on, I think the bigger question is what is it that prosecutors find that could impact whether Trump can run for reelection again? And I think that's probably the big question. I mean, I'd imagine that, you know, it seems like the panel is confident that there will be criminal charges. I can't imagine, that being ignored.
Well, but Alex, this decision has to be made by this committee this year, right? Because they could be out of business by the end of the year, and they know that. So they're not going to wait to see what Donald Trump does about 2024, right? They've got to decide go for broke or not.
I imagine this is not the way that things are supposed to work, but I imagine that there are behind the scenes conversations with the White House and maybe with the Department of Justice.
Not already.
I don't know, but you know, if they do that, the politics of this are real. That if the January 6th committee, which is controlled by Democrats and Liz Cheney, if they do make a criminal referral, it puts Merrick Garland and therefore the Biden administration in a really tough spot. And so I don't know that Merrick Garland is considering the politics, but I imagine the members of Congress who have to run for election every 2 years certainly are. And, you know, they're aware of that. And so I don't know. I mean, and this is the thing that we keep seeing with these Trump investigations where they, you know, there's a lot of smoke. We could maybe prosecute him on something, but then there's always this pullback at the last minute to actually, you know, do any kind of prosecution. And this came up on the campaign trail. You know, Biden was asked about it and he sort of waved it off. But the kind of impression was that he was not comfortable with the idea of prosecuting a former president. So, you know, the reality of this is that politics are involved. I mean, it's not just a strict legal matter. He's not just a private citizen, and there are constitutional and democratic questions. Like this is a precedent that you would be setting that, you know, is potentially dangerous. And there are lots of countries where once a leader gets out of power, they, you know, often end up in prison or facing investigations, prosecutions, and we don't really want to go that way.
Okay, so while the war was raging and the State of the Union was ringing out, there was a lot of political activity this week. It started actually, let's take a look at the various aspects of it. It started actually last weekend with CPAC down in Florida, and our own Sharice Date was down there reporting on CPAC, Donald Trump giving delivering his usual message about the election being stolen. What was your takeaway from the CPAC conference, Sharice?
One thing to remember is CPAC has always been the fringe of the party, right? These are not necessarily serious people who've been even back in the early Obama era, even before then. Remember when McCain got the nomination and Romney was going to be the hero. Romney was a real Republican against McCain. And they booed when he announced that he had stopped his campaign against McCain in 2008. Remember that? So this is never really the mainstream of the right wing of the party even. Now, even the philosophical underpinnings of this, sometimes you had libertarians, sometimes you had social conservatives, all that's gone. All of that is now gone. I remember when Jeb Bush, I think, gave the Ronald Reagan dinner. Tulsi Gabbard gave it this time. Tulsi Gabbard, okay, who is what you might even call a social democrat, is giving the Ronald Reagan dinner. Ronald Reagan is rolling over in his grave in California right now. But this is ridiculous. The party has become CPAC has become the cultiest of the cult for Donald Trump. That's it. Where you stand on Donald Trump is decides whether you get invited or not. Liz Cheney was not invited. Tulsi Gabbard was. All you need to know. Yeah. So, you know, but if I can add just one thing on the Please. on the Justice Department and my sense is that they are going to go forward and charge people involved in the conspiracy. I wouldn't at all be surprised to see people like Stephen Miller, Mark Meadows, people very close to Trump charged with blocking an official proceeding. And frankly, I wouldn't be surprised if Trump himself were charged. I mean, I remember Merrick Garland's speech on January 6th, and the president has said. Now, yeah, he said during the campaign trail that he didn't want to go after Trump, but that was before he tried to overthrow the Republic, right? There's a difference between doing crimes in office and various things, not turning over documents, even extorting Ukraine over trying to dig up dirt. This was very different what happened. And I think Biden and I think Merrick Garland appreciate that. And that's why we're seeing kind of the slow grind toward probably indictments of people very close to the former president.
Well, I agree with you that I think they have to go forward. They must go forward. But we'll see if indeed they do. But let's come back to the politics. Leah, you take a look at it for your newsletter nationwide. Texas, the first primaries of the year, with some interesting results at the gubernatorial level and the attorney general level. What do you see happening out there?
Yeah, it was a fun night of results there. We do have a governor's race. The governor's race is set. It's going to be Greg Abbott, the Republican governor, and Democrat Beto O'Rourke. He actually won with, like, I think 90% of the vote in the primary, which is pretty impressive. But also keeping in mind that just way fewer Democrats turned out than Republicans, which is concerning to some Democrats. The Democrats say, you know, that there are fewer competitive Democratic races. You can't compare general election numbers and primary numbers, et cetera, et cetera. But I think the question you're probably getting at is Ken Paxton, Attorney General, who did not go in Texas. There's a runoff provision where in the primary you need to get 50% of the vote in order to win the nomination outright. Otherwise, the top two vote getters compete in like May. So the runoff season is going to be really long. And so we have Ken Paxton, the incumbent, going against George P. Bush. So last kind of breath of the Bush dynasty in Texas. It seems like Paxton probably is in a stronger position. He's faced some tough elections before and some tough circumstances and survived. We'll see.
But this is the ultimate test, isn't it, of Donald Trump's endorsement power?
Well, that's the thing. There are so many races where Trump in Texas endorsed candidates who had already kind of won the primary. Candidates who are just so we're never facing real competition. Mm-hmm. Greg Abbott ended up having Trump's endorsement, but faced some very Trumpy candidates. Abbott ended up with about 66%, I believe, of the vote. I think votes are still being counted. So, you know, that shows you that Trump's endorsement probably matters, but it's not the end all be all. And there are still endorsements across the country. It's in Alabama's Senate race, in Georgia's governor's race, in Alaska's Senate race, where his endorsed candidates aren't in the lead right now in early polling. So, I mean, Trump's endorsement is such a it's hard to compare across the board because sometimes he endorses some real candidates who are on the path to winning, and other times it's like, you know, I think he's now trying to be more careful to not endorse people who look like they're going to lose. And in Texas, I think he did that. I think he learned that lesson. In 2022, though, he's already made some decisions that he can't turn around on in other states.
So, Alex, one other governor who is getting Republicans getting a lot of attention because he's the one Republican, a potential candidate for 2024, who refuses to say whether he would or would not run against Donald Trump. And that, of course, is the governor of Florida, DeSantis, who stirred up a little trouble this week when he walked into a news conference, a photo op with a group of high school students who were, as required, well, not as required, but as, I guess, advised, wearing masks. And the governor very publicly, right in front of all the cameras, turned on them. Here's Governor DeSantis.
You do not have to wear those masks. I mean, please take them off. Honestly, it's not doing anything, and we got to stop with this COVID theater. So if you want to wear it, fine, but this is ridiculous.
He was criticized by parents and school administrators and others, and he defended himself and still said that masks are nothing but political theater. What's he up to, Alex?
Well, it's rude. It's, not nice, but unfortunately it might be good politics. We're in a moment where what I often think of as like the Disney movie values, are not in vogue in politics, you know, what you learn in kindergarten about sharing and being nice. Meanness, cruelty is a little bit, popular right now. But I think what DeSantis, why he's so interesting, is there's been this talk for years with Trump when you talk to Republicans and they say, well, you know, if only he would stop tweeting, or if only he would stop making stupid decisions, or if only he'd be a little bit more strategic. But of course, Trump is not going to stop doing any of those things because he's Donald Trump. He's impulsive. He's not a cerebral 12th dimensional chess player. Ron DeSantis is, I don't know if he's playing 12 dimensions chess, but he is more of a strategic player. And I think he's kind of testing that idea of, can you have Trumpism, but a more like calculated, controlled Trumpism? You know, he's not tweeting crazy things all the time. He's not giving these like off the cuff interviews where he's not prepared to give answers. And so far it seems to be working. You know, if he has to go up against Trump directly, that's a different question. But for Republicans who are looking for an alternative to Trump, but still think that there's a lot of what Trump did that was, you know, clearly successful and that needs to be preserved in some kind of future candidate, DeSantis is trying to be that next stop for them.
So he's not an anti-Trumper. He's like a Trumper, but who's not Trump.
He's like a 2.0. He's like a Trump 2.0. He's taking the recipe and trying to, you know, shave off some of the edges and make it a little bit more efficient, a little bit more higher performance.
Is your sense, Alex, that he's going to run against would run against Trump in a primary?
If you know, current trends continue and Trump is as strong as he is now, that seems unlikely. DeSantis is a young guy. He could run again. He could serve another term. He could, you know, run for Senate. He could go on Fox News, whatever. But if, say, Trump gets indicted, if Trump has a health issue, if for some reason he becomes less popular with the conservative base, then I think he'd be far more likely to run. And, you know, the politics is weird and unpredictable and things happen all the time. So I think he's making a smart bet to be ready just in case.
Would anybody else challenge Trump, Leah?
Others would, but I think the others that would be like Larry Hogan, you know, like anti-Trump.
Yeah. Hasn't he said no?
Republican. So 2024?
Yeah, I thought he had.
I mean, I also don't believe anybody who says no 2 years out.
Yeah, true.
So that's part of it. I mean, I think you'd see anti-Trump Republicans lining up to run against him. None of them at this point would have a chance. Ron DeSantis is just the only person who Trump is afraid of. He's the only person who's managed to kind of stand up to him, and not in terms of like ideology, but just in terms of, you know, saying, you know, he didn't show up to a Trump event recently, you know, in Florida. He's willing to kind of buck the president while also kind of being the president. I think Trump 2.0 is a really good way to put it. He's definitely the name to watch in 2024, whether or not Trump runs again.
All right. Take us to the other side, Sharice. Does Joe Biden run for re-election?
Yeah, of course he runs for re-election. I mean, unless there's a pressing health concern that that says that he should not or could not. And even if he weren't going to run, he's not going to say this until late 20, you know, and at least until mid 2023, and he's not going to stiff his vice president. So, but you know, DeSantis is a really interesting guy. The first time I saw him was at a Frank Luntz moderated event when he was running against Adam Putnam. Adam Putnam, who entered the Florida legislature when he was like 12, you know, and I covered that back in like 1996, and he's been running for governor pretty much since then. And he was going to roll through this and he was going to be the next governor of Florida. And here was Ron DeSantis, and all he had was potentially a Trump endorsement. And this was before he got that. And he was on stage. He was reasonable. He was thoughtful. He knew things. Mm. He knew a lot of stuff. And then he got the endorsement from Trump, and then he acted like Trump. And then he was elected and he behaved like Charlie Crist or Jeb Bush for his first year before COVID hit. And then he became again like Donald Trump. So this is this guy who can turn it on and off. And one point I'll mention here is that I went to CPAC 2 years in a row, both in Florida. And the only person who did not mention Trump at all in either year was Ron DeSantis.
Wow. Yeah.
All the other candidates, potential candidates in 2024, mentioned Trump last year, and a whole bunch of them didn't this year. So I would disagree. I think these people are ambitious. They want to be president. They see this guy who was a yutz, and they messed it up by letting him get the nomination last time. They're not going to make that mistake again. I see Ted Cruz running. I see Rick Scott running. I even see Marco Rubio running.
Again,
against Trump, whether he runs or not. And plus, you know, there's a decent chance he's going to get indicted in Georgia. Then the Trump base won't care. And they'll say he's being persecuted. And Trump, of course, has you know, already laid the groundwork for this. But these others can make a very reasonable argument that, hey, how is that guy going to run for president if he's constantly has to go and for court appearances and things, right? This is just not best. Maybe he can wait another 4 years. So, yeah, I think DeSantis definitely runs.
All right. Well, that's what makes politics so much fun for all of us to cover. And there'll be lots more between now and the rest of the primaries this year and then moving into 2024. Thank you so much to today's panels. Great job, Alex Seitzwald, Leah Askaranam, and Sharish Date. Before we let you go, we always want to know the one story that caught your attention during the week, made you at least stop and think about it, maybe laugh, maybe cry. Alex, start us off. Your favorite story of the week.
Well, this is a political story, and it's about Texas. I maybe know where I'm going with this one. Congressman Van Taylor, who's not a household name, but he was forced into a runoff. He had a primary challenge, and that's not the most interesting thing, although that is fairly interesting. The more interesting thing is that as soon as that came out, he announced he is quitting the race and therefore quitting Congress, not running for re-election. Admitting that he had an affair. Okay, so now we're getting very interesting. But it gets much more interesting than that, which is that the woman he had an affair with is none other than the quote-unquote ISIS bride, who is a woman in Texas who was married to a top ISIS commander. I have no idea how this came together, but that's one of those stories where you're reading it and it just, you know, it's already very interesting and then takes a major twist partway through. And I have so many more questions that I want answered now.
So I can't wait to hear the rest of that story, as Paul Harvey used to say, right? Yeah, it raised you, as you said. How did he connect with this ISIS bride? Well, Alex, get to work. Do a little research there.
My calls.
How about it, Leah? What caught your attention?
You know, you'll never believe it, but that's the one that I was going to bring up, too.
All right.
I audibly gasped when I saw that it was Van Taylor personally, just because that was not a name I would have expected to see there. But there's another fun fact from the Texas results. In the governor's race, a guy named Rick Perry got 62,000 votes, with I think votes still being counted. Now, this is not the former governor.
Oh, no.
This is Rick L. Perry, who we don't really know anything about. But having his name on the ballot with basically zero campaign apparatus behind him still got 62,000 votes, about 3% in a primary. So, name recognition. It's an important thing in politics.
That's what it's all about. I'm sure the former governor, right, says those were votes for me. And they probably they probably were, right? Okay.
I'd imagine so.
Sharish, do you want to make it three in a row for Van Taylor, or did you have a different favorite story of the week?
I have a different favorite. It was written by Chris Mathias, who a colleague of mine, who came to CPAC as well, but to attend a different conference. There's like a white nationalist conference that kind of trolls CPAC by, if CPAC isn't crazy enough for you, this is the one you go to. It's called the America First Political Action Committee. And they had a super guest speaker, their keynote guy, Tom Homan, who used to be the ICE director under Trump, who showed up, was going to go on stage, and then realized, maybe I should check these people out, and Googled Nick Fuentes for the first time, supposedly, and realized that he's a white nationalist, and left without ever taking the stage. Now, this is the event that Marjorie Taylor Greene showed up at you know, and gave her speech and then was defending her appearance afterward. Wendy Rogers from Arizona was also there. So this is kind of funny that you would go down to Florida to attend a conference, but not really know, supposedly, you know, what it was all about.
That I hadn't heard that story. That is fascinating indeed. Well, my favorite story back here to Washington, D.C., also has to do with political rivalries. And it seems to be the growing rivalry between Rick Scott, whom Donald Trump is urging to run against Mitch McConnell, and McConnell himself. And it came to light this week. And I got to tell you, I'm no fan of Mitch McConnell's, but he is one smart, savvy politician with a lot of years of experience. And he knows when to play hardball, when he has to play hardball. So Rick Scott had released, as we know, this 10-point program. This is what the Republicans, what we Republicans are going to stand for if we take over the Senate. One of those measures included having everybody in the United States pay some share of income taxes, which would raise taxes on over half of the American population. Mitch McConnell was asked, so what do you think about Senator Scott's program? And Mitch McConnell didn't hesitate to, well, here he is.
Well, Senator Scott is behind me, and he can address the issue of his particular measure. If we're fortunate enough to have the majority next year, I'll be the majority leader. We will not have as part of our agenda a bill that raises taxes on half of the American people and sunsets Social Security and Medicare within 5 years.
What I love about that, I'm sure the panelists all do too, is he said it right in front of Rick Scott, and he didn't hesitate. I remember the old wag that if you want a friend in Washington is someone who will stab you in the chest, not stab you in the back. Well, Mitch McConnell certainly did that this week. What do you think, Alex? That was a moment, huh?
It was definitely a moment. And speaking of 2024 a minute ago and Floridians who might run, that's how I read this document that Rick Scott put out. I mean, it was from the NRSC chair, but you know, how many Americans know who the chairman of the NRSC is? How many Americans even know what the NRSC is? Which, by the way, is the National Republican Senatorial Committee, mm-hmm. and Rick Scott is the chair. So to me, it's like a glossy brochure. There's all these nice photos of Rick Scott and all these quotes from him. There are no mentions of other Republican senators, at least that I saw, not prominently. This seemed like a promotion for one man. So I think what's going on here is, you know, this has been no secret that Rick Scott is eyeing a potential presidential run, and I think he's kind of using his auspices as the NRSC chairman to put this out, and then for personal reasons, and then Mitch McConnell saw a political liability here and smacked that down pretty quickly.
Yeah. So, Leah, the message is don't mess with Mitch, I guess, huh?
Yeah, love him or hate him, but he's like you said, politically savvy. Like I said, I don't think you can argue that there aren't major divisions in the Republican Party, obviously.
Yeah, indeed. All right. Hey, panelists, great job today. Thank you so much for being with us and your insights into the news of the week. We say again a big thank you to SV Date, who's White House correspondent for HuffPost, to Alex Seitzwald, senior digital politics reporter for NBC News, and Leah Iskaranam, and her new post as co-author of the On Politics newsletter with the New York Times. That's it for today, but we'll be back on Tuesday with the Bill Press Pod, where we're going to take an in-depth look into that report of the January 6th committee charging the president and some of his allies with a criminal conspiracy to overturn the 2020 election. What do they detail? What do they recommend? And what are the possible consequences? Coming up on the next edition of the Bill Press Pod. Meanwhile, take care of yourself, be strong, be safe, and then come back and see us next time on the Bill Press Pod.
Look around. You can find cars like these on AutoTrader. New cars, used cars, electric cars, maybe even flying cars. Okay, no flying cars, but as soon as they get invented, they'll be on AutoTrader. Just you wait. AutoTrader.